I'm at this pop-up dinner in the Hamptons, and the chef is a good friend. We did a pop-up with him in LA. He comes up to me and is like, "You're sitting next to the owner of the Mets tonight." And I'm like, "Owner of the Mets? Isn't that Stevie Cohen, like 0.72 sack capital, the guy that they made Billions, like the TV show Billions is like kind of modeled after him?" Like, I wonder if it's that owner. I was thinking maybe someone else. And, you know, it was him, and he's there with his wife, and she was lovely. And we just sat right next to each other, like catty corner. And we're just chatting. And I was trying not to let on, you know, even though I'm a big sports fan, and just being chill. And the chef kept like showing him all the hex clad because he just loves cooking on our pans. And the next thing you know, he tells me who he is and his wife. And so, and then I start talking about golf. Like, guys talk about sports. So I'm talking about golf. And next thing you know, it's like, "I'm going to be traveling with the team this week, but are you going to be out here in the Hamptons next week? Because you can come play with me at my club." And I'm like, "Wait a minute. I got this incredible like business titan who's inviting me to go play golf because I just talked about golf with him. I'm like, I got to get better at golf. So I'm actually not going to be in town next week, but I'm going to come back next year." And so I sent him some cookware. His wife sent me the nicest email, like, "Hope our paths cross again." It's like, just so genuine. It was super, super cool. So learn how to play golf.
Yeah. And so that's Jason's story. And my comment to that is, he didn't play any golf. He turned down playing golf with the billionaire. The real story is, no, I guess, world-class chefs and sponsor them with your cookware and get invited to parties with them. Like, that's the real lesson.
The lesson is not to do,
get invited to an exclusive dinner in the Hamptons, and the rest takes care of itself.
Yeah.
The Jason Panzer story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How to be successful.
And then have the to say no to him. Yeah. Do you know that guy is so rich, he paid so much in taxes that when he moved out of New Jersey, the governor called him directly and asked him to move back? That's a real story. He left.
Come on.
He took 1% of New Jersey state revenue with him because he moved to Florida. And he's like, "Yeah, my wife wants to move to Florida." Like, that's who you know rich people control the country, because when I left California, Newsom didn't call me, bud. he did not give a by me.
Welcome to the Operators Podcast. We're going to get right into it today. We got the whole crew here. This is going to be a different episode. We asked for questions. We got a ton of them. I've picked through them. I think I sent you guys in the chat like some of them that I want to dig into. So if it's all cool, I'm going to start at the top. We're going to dig into questions today and see if we can make an episode about it and maybe like do this on the regular, because we got a ton of feedback in
the questions come from the Slack group, right?
Yeah, man. And if you're not in the Slack group and you're listening to this, you're an idiot. Jump in the Slack group. It's like there's action there.
Right. So you know how sitcoms do clip shows? This is our version of a clip show. It's like, yeah, we couldn't think of a topic. We're doing Q&A, everybody.
Q&A. So we've always got topics, but I think it's actually good to see like what's the top of mind for other people, like the people that are listening, right? And some of the questions too, I'm like, we've already gone into this, but maybe we actually just need to go into it again. So I'll ask, and then I'll let you guys know like, you know, which order to answer in. I want to start with I kind of put these in an order. If each of you were starting your business today, maybe this business or another one, let's say you're dumb enough and you like consumer enough to go back into consumer, what's one thing you would do differently today? If you were starting from scratch right now, Jason, then Mike, then Sean this time.
Yeah. You know what? I think the first thing I would do, let's leave the product aside, right? Because don't even start anything without a good product. But like my first execution point is, I'm actually thinking about this right now. I'm not going to tell anyone on the pod what it is, but like, I would probably just like set it up on Amazon, like, because the customers are there, right? It's like, go and fucking sell it on Amazon and see if anyone buys it. It doesn't cost you that much. You don't have to buy that much in paid ads. Like just see what happens. That's what I would do. I think the audience is there. The people are there. Go where the consumers are. Go where the customers are. It seems really hard to go and I mean, yeah, sure, I'd probably set up Shopify because it's easy, but going and paying, running paid ads, seems like it's gotten really hard. So I don't envy people that are about to go start something either, to be honest.
Very cool. Mike, what are your thoughts, man? What would you do differently today?
What Jason just said is basically exactly how we started Simple Modern. So it's good advice. Here's the thing I would say, two things. First, I would say, to use an analogy, if I'm standing on the beach, I'm not looking at the waves that are about to crash. I'm looking at probably 50, 100, 150 feet offshore and looking for little bitty swells that are going to turn into big waves. So what I mean by that is I would be looking at product trends that were just starting to emerge, things that were starting. One of the ways you can do this is look at Google Trends. You can look at Amazon search term volume, which they publish this. If you have an account in the marketplace, you can look at it. And I'd be looking for what are some key terms that like last month went from 800,000 to 750 or 800,000 to 650,000, where they're not necessarily huge yet, but it's a trend that's developing. And I would jump in there. I hate jumping into categories where I don't know there's demand, but I have no problem getting in early. And also like the amount of competition is going to be less. And then the second thing I would do is I would really leverage the expertise I've developed in these different sales channels, specifically the Amazons, you know, Targets, Walmarts of the world. And I would build around that because your ability to get to the first few million in sales, 10 million in sales, it's a heck of a lot easier when you can leverage somebody else's distribution than when you have to do it via marketing, in my opinion.
Sean.
Well, I like this oldest to youngest. So we can keep that up. You want to end on like a strong young man. I totally get that.
Invigorating.
Age before beauty.
So on the product side, it has to go on or in you. If I'm doing something, it is going inside of your mouth or it's going on your skin. It's like no other product category makes any sense. So on or in, that's the first thing. And I would either become a celebrity or partner with a celebrity, whichever one you think is easier. So I do not want to go compete in saturated markets of Amazon and spend money on Facebook ads. Like, we are back in the organic reach era for a little bit longer. Milk the hell out of that. So when we launched watches, I posted on Twitter about it. I think 30% of the watches we sold on day one was my friends and supporters on Twitter rallying around me to see me succeed. So thank you to everyone who did that. Jason bought one of the watches. So yeah, it's a free gift that is being offered by the paid social or social media gods. Embrace that, become a celebrity or partner with a celebrity and make something that goes in or on you. That's all I would do.
You know, so here's the comment. All three of you guys immediately went to solving reach. That's the thing. Like, you different, right? But like every single one of you, your first thought was to go for reach.
I want to comment on that, Matt. I teach, as you guys know, at OU. And so every semester I probably work with 8 to 10 groups of students that have like startup ideas. What I have found is the single most common fatal flaw to any business plan is that they do not address how to sustainably and affordably acquire customers. Like, it's the reach problem.
Yeah, you know, we were lied to. If you build a better mousetrap, nobody cares because I have a really awesome, funny TikTok video I want to watch, right? Like, you actually have to get in front of people, and doing that for as cheaply as possible is the best thing. And if someone has a creative way to do that, please DM me. I would love to get in front of as many people as possible for free. But the reality is Amazon's a great place for that. You know, being early to an emerging trend, that's just being there when other people start searching for it. That's what Mike's talking about. And for me, it's like, just get really good at creating content, become a little celebrity.
I want to ask a follow-up to that, the content question, because I think, Sean, I know that we've talked about this in the past, but why don't brands now actually try to get good at creating content? Like if you were starting over right now, you would actually go and like either partner up or figure out how to make content. And yet very few brands have this muscle.
It's because the perceived limit is low, right? I think maybe Mr. Beast and Feastables is raising what that limit is, but we know Isaac Mini Katana, good friend of all of ours, is the absolute goat at organic content. Maybe Peachy Slime, another friend of ours, both of them are doing
Kevin, Epic.
Yeah. Like all of these people are doing high seven figures, low eight figures, maybe to mid eight figures, right? Like that is what kind of the cap of organic reach has been, right? Now, there's a couple of examples. I think Kith is a multi-$100 million business that has no ad budget. That is organic reach. That is organic awareness, right? Supreme was the same thing. You can sustain hype cycles organically, right? But really this like new age creating content, like it's perceived as like a high seven, low eight figure cap. And for Ridge right now to get into it, I would love an extra, you know, $9 million. That'd be awesome. But I have bigger opportunities in front of me, but that's just because I'm already established, already rich, right? But if I'm starting over, I have nothing. There is $10 million in front of you every single year if you just get good at this one skill, right?
So it's also the fire. Like, I think that's the important thing, Sean, that like people should understand is if you're great at that piece, you can pour paid on top of it.
Right.
Like paid is the gas, right? What you're talking about is like, go build a good fire. And that's the content engine.
Yeah. And I think that is a good analogy that paid is gas. Unfortunately, what I really think it is that organic social is your fire and then paid's your shelter. Like they're both important things, but they actually complete different parts of the campsite because I haven't seen a brand be great at organic and layer on paid correctly. I'm sure there's some examples, right? But like, who has actually done that? Kith isn't running ads. Mini Katana starting to, right? Maybe they break the mold. But Feastables gave up on D2C. They're like, we're in Walmart. We're just going to make videos about Walmart, right? Like they've given up on the paid aspect of D2C. So I think it's completing your little Minecraft build, right? It's like, it's completing your Lego set. It's different pieces doing different things. They are additive, but they actually don't multiply. That's one idea.
A common thread, Matt, it applies to the way that we all tried to answer reach, I think, is you have to find a way to be first order profitable and to be able to acquire people fairly inexpensively. I would definitely not want to get into D2C where my answer to first order profitable is charge insane margins and just hope I can, I can make the marketing numbers work. And so I think that's one of the reasons why Amazon's so attractive is that, and why mass retail is so attractive to me is that you're first order profitable on that customer acquisition. And this is the reason organic, Sean, what you're talking about is so attractive is that you're able to acquire customers where your CAC is really low or nothing. And as a result, you're first order profitable. You can't, trying to scale a consumer business that you are bootstrapping when you're not making significant money on that first order is just an exercise in sadism. I mean, it's so hard, you don't want to do it.
Yeah. You said a common thread that unites. Well, I was at dinner with the common thread himself, Taylor Holiday, and he made the observation. It is a 100 point game. There is nothing more than 100 percentage points. So the percentage points have to come from somewhere. Product, marketing, profitability, whatever. And for Ridge, marketing is 30 percentage points. So if I could get organic marketing, it's 30 percentage points, it's going to profit or product, right? So you can have a lower margin good if you get rid of, if you shift those buckets around, right? And, tying in Jason, the man himself, he is in a place where he's finding percentage points. He just did this whole repackaging, right, to save 2 percentage points on shipping stuff in, right? And he's doing that because those percentage points can either go to profit or marketing to scale the business. So it's all 100 point stack that we're pulling from.
Yeah. Sean, and in the beginning you're not just 1%.
You said something about like, so organic, like scaling organic versus scaling paid, and you haven't seen guys do a great job, like if they're really good at organic scaling paid. it does seem that some people are really good at paid and some people are really good at organic, and it's hard to be good at both. And it may be just the category. It may be just like the viral nature of what goes on in organic. I think we're not great at either. We're like probably a little bit better at paid because we're just lucky that we have Gordon, and a good product and a visually appealing product. We hired someone to run organic content for us in January, and we're really investing in that. It's getting better. And now I'm like, wait a minute, our paid ads need to be better. And I'm interviewing candidates right now to basically be the head of paid ad creative at Hexclad. And it's very interesting. So most of these people want to work remote and want to make between $200,000 and $250,000 a year for that. And like, they're not living in LA. They're living in like Wisconsin or North Carolina, working remote for $200,000 to $250,000. Like, that's pretty good. Like, that's a pretty good gig, right? Like, what do you guys think of that?
What's up, everybody? It's Sean from the Operators Podcast. I'm doing push-ups, but I'm here to tell you about Fulfill, my favorite ERP. I have 30 seconds, so let me think about it. It does accounting. It does order management. If you do wholesale, it helps with ERP or EDI stuff. It's fantastic. Please get on it so I can stop doing push-ups. It is the best order management thing you're going to use. I love you, Fulfill. Talk to you later.
I think it's just a sign of like the, we're in a, I think Sean nailed it, man. I think this is like a sign, we're in a moment in time where creative matters a lot, and that there's like a small amount of people that can do it at a high level. Like we have a supply issue in talent is what I get from that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the first point, is that how come some brands are really good at organic and some brands are really good at paid, and they haven't, there hasn't been cross-pollination yet. It is, it's very hard for a native Chinese speaker to learn English, and it's very hard for an English speaker to learn Chinese. It's because the languages are totally different, right? Like, it's one's tonal, one's not, grammar, whatever. And if you're an organic first brand, you put a video out, there's no fucking tracking. People Google you, come to your website and their sales or whatever. And if you're a paid brand, you're like, I have all my UTMs, everything set up. It is entirely different DNA and infrastructure. So the reason why an organic brand has never gone to paid is because it is the exact opposite way of they think, right? It's like, it's maybe there'll be anomalies, but I think it is easier for a rich paid brand to be like, we'll bolt on organic, right? Now, you in 3 years, when it comes time to cut costs and sell your business to PE, they're going to totally destroy your organic content department because it adds intrinsic value, not trackable value, right? But anyway, sorry to derail it, but like that's...
I want to stack on that, Sean, because I think you're making a great point. What my observation is, so I was talking to Connor last week, who's, Ridge's CMO, and he was basically saying, hey, I was listening to the pod and what you're talking about with products, about trying to launch products every 2 or 3 days. And he's like, that's pretty much what we do right now with marketing, but we want to get to where we can do more of that on the product side. And I'm like, well, that's ironic because we're kind of the opposite. We're really doing that well in product, where we're dropping stuff all the time, but we haven't built that muscle in marketing. We're with creative. We are churning. I mean, he was showing me like how much you guys churn out in a week, Sean, and it's amazing. And here's the observation, especially in this hypothetical, we're talking about starting a business. If you can get one core aspect of your business working like a factory, like an assembly line, then you're doing awesome. And these are all disparate, right? You want to have a really robust product pipeline where you are bringing a lot of stuff to market, like that's going to take a certain set of muscles. And that's a very different set of muscles than having a really robust creative, you know, paid creative pipeline. And that's a very different set of muscles than what like Isaac is doing with Mini Katana. Like Isaac has shown us, like they have basically a factory for organic content and they do it really well, but like that's a totally different muscle than trying to figure out how we can drop a new ornamentation every third day. And it's very unrealistic to expect that as a smaller company that you're going to be able to do more than one thing in that way really well. So you've got to kind of pick what's the one thing that we're going to turn into kind of like an assembly line where we're just going to really develop this core competency and hone in on that.
You know, can I want to add something to that, Sean, real quick before you just, and I'll go back to you. On the why are organic people not good at paid? Like, Mike, I don't disagree with you, but I think it has way more to do with organic. People who are good at organic are allergic to spending money on paid. They literally, like, they put out organic content and sales come in for free. And then you show up and you say, now I want you to pay this 30% tax. And they throw up. The minute it's like, whoa, that costs a lot of money. Like, and I don't have to pay that if I just do more organic, they stop. Whereas the paid company, like a Ridge, is like, I currently pay a 30% tax to these big companies. I'm going to take it a step further, Matt.
It's not even that they're allergic to spending money. It's just like, okay, for me to bolt on paid now, I've got to learn all these other disciplines and I have to pay for it. It's so much easier for me to just ramp up the factory and put out 30% more content or 40% more videos, right? Because I've got that muscle and I'm good at that. So let's just put out more organic content if I want more reach, because that's what we do and we do really well.
No, I just wanted to point out the irony that we have four people on this call who don't do organic, who are talking about how great it is. And it could be grass is greener. Isaac would be on here right now being like, you guys are the stupidest people on earth, paid's where it's at. But to the heart of the question is, if we were starting over today, what would we do? And that is the obvious opportunity ahead of us, is that you can get a couple million dollars in sales, figure the rest of be open to paid in the future, but you can get a couple million dollars in sales being good at organic. And Jason's right that like the talent isn't there. Brands want to get into this. I'm paying a huge premium to hire people who are good at this. And it's like the legacy players don't have the advantage, right? Look for that in markets that are emerging. Like Walmart has no idea how to do organic social. So like you could actually win a little bit right now. And Jason's trying to win. I'm trying to win. We have to pay a premium. And we're at the cutting edge of doing that from a brand perspective.
Yeah, totally agree. So I want to evolve it to one of the other questions we got, which I think just is like a nice next sort of question to this one, which is like, what is the big, so beyond the starting blocks, let's say like 0 to 1, 0 to 10, what do you think is the biggest unlock that got each of you from like 10 to 50 to 100 in revenue? Like, was it product? Was it markets? Was it channels? Maybe this time we'll go in reverse. Sean, Mike, Jason.
Nice. So best to worst. I totally got you on that one. Obviously. I got a joke every time, guys.
Ageist. Well, Sean is an ageist. It's coming out. Discriminating against Jason.
No. I love Jason. He's good friends with my bestie Stevie Cohen. So they're hanging out. I gotta respect that.
He's just jealous shout of out. My fitness levels at 52 years old.
Dude, you're not wrong. I mean, Jason, I think you sent a video. The guy knocked out 25 chin-ups or something crazy. Like, it's like let's see some marketing nerds doing 25 chin-ups. That's hard. So, shout out. I think this is Zach Stuck who sent this question in. Right, Zach runs an amazing agency that Jason uses and I've used for some things in the past. He has a brand portfolio of a couple brands doing, I think, collectively 8 figures in revenue, but he wants to get one of them to 9, right? What is the unlock to get you there? And we don't have one. What I'll tell you is it was bumbling along. You know, here's my real answer. Lower your MER targets. Like, just spend more. Like, figure out how low you can go and still generate a dollar in profit, and you can get there. I mean, I think the ultimate answer is, like, revenue is not what we're judged on, right? No company's selling for a revenue multiple. Everyone's selling for EBITDA multiples. And you want to show consistent, strong EBITDA growth year over year. You want to show increasing gross margin year over year. You want to show a predictable, steady, up and to the right business. And that's what Ridge has been able to build. Now, I don't think Zach's trying to sell or whatever, but like, nine figures is the outcome that happens after doing everything correctly for 5 or 10 years in a row.
For a long time.
Yeah.
Mike, what about you, man? Was there one thing? Was there two things? Was there like a sequence that, you know, was the real, like a major, like, okay, if we just do these in order, we're going to get there?
Yeah. The two I would point to are channels. And okay, we're the most omni-channel. But listen, there is nothing easier than I've got a product that I know the quality, I know the economics, I'm selling X, and now I can sell it these two other places and I'm selling 3X. Like, it does not get any easier than that. So anytime you can find a way to activate more channels, it's the easiest growth unlock that exists. And so for us, the trend we started, as I mentioned earlier, we started exactly how Jason talked about. Our first sale was on the marketplace, and it was a pretty big day for the company when we sold our first unit in Target, which I guess we sold in Sam's Club before Target, but Target was really where we started selling our branded product every day somewhere else. And that was the beginning of a different trajectory for the company. The second thing I would say, and this is more of a culture thing, you can get to 5 million, you can get to 10 million, you can get to 15 million with scrappiness and, as the founder, just being awesome and God level e-commerce, you know, big brain. You can't get to nine figures without building a team. Can't do it. Can't sustainably do it, at least. I mean, maybe there have been people that have had a moment, but like, you, even if you do it without a team because of some kind of virality or something, it's going to implode upon itself. And so the level up that's required, I think, as the leader or the CEO, is you have to be coaching, and you have to be hiring well, you have to be coaching and developing those people, and you have to be growing the base of leaders, because that's ultimately, you know, what wins over time, is that you develop a real core of leaders that are smart and can make good judgments. And there's just so much more surface area for expansion and for opportunities. So those are the two things I'd recommend: activate channels, develop leaders, and grow your team.
Awesome. Jason, let's go to you. And then I got a thought on this.
You know, I think that you have to, like, it goes back to getting to the customer. How do you reach the customer? Like, get in front of people. Hexclad did really very little on D2C. Until probably getting to 10 million in sales in Costco alone. Like, it was the perfect match, demonstration of a product that was like befitting, like, it was a highly demonstrable product. So guys just went out there, they knew how to sell it in front of people. They got their product in front of people, in front of eyeballs. In front of a lot of eyeballs at Costco, right? Because you've got thousands of people walking by the booth every day. So I think it goes back to the way you summed it up, Matt. It's like, how do you get reach? How do you get in front of people? Mike is like, you know, look at all the channels, go omni-channel. I agree with that. I think the pure play D2C story is near impossible right now with just the cost, like what Meta is going to take, even what Amazon is going to take. Sean's out here talking about how Amazon making their money on ads now. It's really, really hard. You have to be super scrappy and get your product in front of people. And the organic side of it too. I think that was a really good point that was made here. It's like, you just get it out there in front of people. There's this, I met this woman who sells these trays. They, it's like a Lucite tray. And she has little like inserts that go on the tray so that you can make the tray look different. And just like Sean said, like she's on TikTok. And like a couple of her TikToks like blew up. Her TikTok blows up. She'll sell a couple hundred grand of these things and then she won't sell very much. So she hasn't been able to like flip it up to the next step. But I really like that, right? She created some, first of all, she's got an interesting differentiated product. And then she found her reach. She found her reach on TikTok. Hexclad found their initial reach in Costco. And then was like, we were like 80% Costco and 20% D2C until March 2020. You know why? Because Costco made a lot of money. It was a good, you know, it just worked, right? It was, we sold plenty, it worked. But then March came around, Costco shut down the roadshow. And Danny and Cole were actually, they took a big risk. They're like, we got all this inventory, we got this cash in the bank. We ain't selling any roadshow sets. So like, let's just put $1 million into paid ads. Let's just do it, guess it. And had no idea what we were doing. It's right around when I got involved full time. And like 5X online sales in a month. So that's kind of a rambling way to get there, but I think kind of got the point across. We're really digging into the MMM, media mix modeling, with Northbeam right now. And we're finding it really valuable. And I got a text this morning from an excellent CMO of one of the best, fastest growing brands out there. And he's like, hey, we just signed on to media mix modeling. So you've got to be a certain size and scale to do it, but we're super stoked about it. In fact, we were thinking about doing some incrementality testing too with something else. And it's like, you know what? Let's stick with the MMM stuff. And it's doing, it's really interesting. I think it's going to add a lot of value for us.
You know, it's again, like just listening and observing you guys, right? When I saw Zach's question, it's like, there's only three ways you can grow any company. So let's just take out TAM. Let's just say that the TAM is there, right? You can get to 100 million, 500 million, the TAM is there. Three ways you can grow any company: product, channels, and markets. That is it. Every activity you're going to do in your business is going to be in one of those things, and that's where growth is going to come from. And each of you just hit on either product, markets, or channels. And all you're ever doing with product, markets, or channels is like, I'm either going for breadth, adding more, or depth. That's it. I'm like vertically scaling in one channel, or I'm expanding to markets. Like in our chat, and we're going to get to this next, but like in our chat, it's interesting how much international is starting to come up. Like I looked yesterday as like I was getting questions. I'm like, holy shit, like Pila Case's revenue, 23% comes from outside of the US and Canada. And that is with like really, I would call like poor execution. And those are markets. Right now, like all we're doing is like spending on one channel, Meta, in those markets with like one set of products, right? And I think like on the episode that we had our boy Jeremy on, you know, you saw it at the mastery of his business was really about like matching up and this matrix of like product, channels, and markets. And that's the key to scale, man. It's not going to be like, it's definitely not going to be one thing. I don't think it's going to be one thing. And I don't know if anyone wants to challenge me on that, but like, that's kind of.
No, Matt, I believe in what you're saying perfectly. It's product or people. You either reach more people or you sell more things. It's like only way to scale. We can get super fancy with it. We can get into strategies, organic and paid and international. And we can talk about like the MER targets that you need to hit and how low to the ground you can fly. At the end of the day, we're trying to sell things to people, either more people or more things, right? The beauty of consumer, the beauty of the world. That's all it comes down to, right?
So do you guys want to go to international next? Because I know this is one that like Jason, you're like, I've seen you asking questions around this. Sean, I know you're poking around. Mike, I don't know if where Simple Modern is on markets right now, but like, do you guys want to go
let's
there?
Do it. Let's
okay. Do it. So, I think there was the question I saw was like, does the way we think about growth change as we like go outside of the US, right? Out of North America. And really, I thought what the interesting one was, how do you localize and think about market expansion? Maybe this time we'll go Mike, Sean, Jason.
Yeah. Well, the way that we think about market expansion is you're trying to do the things that have been successful for you already in a new geography. And so for us, like, we're going to expand internationally on the backs of Amazon. It's the most natural. If you look at the Amazon ecosystem, it's pretty embryonic in places like Europe and Australia and Japan and India compared to the United States. The United States is the biggest market, doing the most volume, and there's the most competition, the most incentive for sellers to come here. And so we have the opportunity as a direct vendor of Amazon. They would like us to be a direct vendor internationally for them as well. For example, in Europe right now, I think we're shipping them their first purchase order, which is, you know, like maybe 100,000 units. But I don't know that they have another direct vendor in drinkware. We may be the only one. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunity for us. And we know that playbook, right? We know the playbook of you expand into a market with Amazon, you start to develop brand recognition and customers, and then you slowly say, hey, what are the attractive physical retail opportunities? And then how do you bridge that to your D2C offerings? And I think that's exactly the playbook we're rolling out right now. So Europe is happening. Canada, you know, I don't know if you call Canada international, Matt, but like North America, you know, Canada and Mexico, the markets are both in a different place than Amazon US. And we've grown Canada, I think, to 5 or 6% of our US volume, but we think we can get to 10 to 12, and Mexico, we think we can get to 6%. So, and then Europe, maybe we can even get it to 50% of the US. So we're pretty optimistic.
Super cool. Jason, what's HexCloud? Like, how are you guys looking at markets now?
So we're probably a little under 10% non-US with not enough effort, but we're growing so fast in the US that it's just really hard. We are UK, all over Europe. We're launching Australia any day now. We've been on Amazon in Canada and Costco in Canada for some time. And we're doing Mexico shortly, both, well, all of Costco, D2C, and Amazon. We are struggling with the decision as to like how localized things need to be in places like Australia, Canada, UK. Like for Canada D2C, do I use locals in Canada? Does it matter? Can I use my US agency? My US team doesn't have time. I'm like, I'm kind of thinking I'm just going to hire a US based agency to just manage Canada for me, because I just don't want to bog down my internal team. It's just US is just too much work. So
you can do that in Canada, by the way. I think in the UK, you're going to find there's like more nuance as you go out. Canada and the US, like we're a colony to America. Like we're like, speaking as the resident Canadian, like,
I'm glad
so
you
much of
it
is similar.
I'm glad you admit it.
Just sorry, Jason, I'm just like, as a Canadian, I think that you're safe behaviorally. There's not enough that's different between the US and Canada, right? Like you can do that. You can just say like, okay, Americans, like you guys market in Canada now. This team, go for it.
Good, because I'm currently fighting with one of the smartest people at HexCloud, and I am taking the exact same position as you, and he's debating me. So I guess that means you
just win. Point him to me.
Well, yeah, here's what Ridge is doing, Jason. I mean, we have a US website, ridge.com. You can go there if you're in the US. You can buy all our stuff. We have 4 warehouses in the US serving those customers. We have ridgewallet.ca, which is localized inventory inside of Canada. Ridgewallet.uk or whatever, like same exact thing. EU, Australia, and we're launching an Asia hub in 6 months or whatever. So we have localized inventory in those markets, separate websites, separate checkout experience with the payment processing those customers like. We have the same marketing team in the US running all of that. It's like everything was in English the entire time, exact copy of the US website, and it got us to 8 figures in international revenue. So you don't got to think too hard. We just turned on German ads with a German landing page with German website, and results did get 50% better, but they were still good to begin with, right? And the next one is going to be French, right? Because you can reach everyone in the Nordics, everyone in Netherlands, Belgium, all of them speak English all of the time, right? 50% of Germany, you can reach them just fine, but like the further away you get from English rule, the more pushback against English you'll get, right? Australia, totally fucking fine. Canada, you shouldn't even be talking about it. It's definitely America, dude. It is not worth switching that stuff out. Maybe in Quebec, you have to run French ads.
Just ignore them. Ignore them. Yeah. Like speaking as the, I know I'm going to piss a bunch of people off who are Canadian, but like, it's not worth the brain damage to deal with Quebec and Canada as an American brand. Like, I would ignore them, right? Yeah. I deal with the brain damage, but I'm Canadian, so like, right. It's normal for us. I grew up around it.
Yeah, so we're launching French as the next one, and then we'll do Italian, we'll do Spanish. Like, we'll start breaking up our EU into more localized markets. Inventory still shipping out of Belgium, right, to reach everybody in the EU. And then with the Asia hub, that's the one that gets the most challenging. I'll let you guys know in 6 months how that goes.
Jason, have you localized inventory in any other markets except for the US? Given the growth rate of your American business?
We have inventory in the UK. We have inventory in Rotterdam serving continental Europe. And we have inventory arriving in Australia very, very soon.
Yeah, Australia is actually like a great market.
Dude, then just use your – it's the same marketing team. You should be able to get that with your size of the business, just having localized inventory, mid-8 figures without adding anybody. You just put the ads into the different markets and you're good to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, Jason, that was sort of my point with Pilacase is like, I'm amazed at how much we do in EU and UK. And all we do is just dupe our ads into those markets and figure out, like, it's like they're not localized in language. We do localize the currency. So like we have like other like sites like what Ridge does in those markets. But we have yet to like hire people in those countries who know the nuances of like culture and language and all that stuff. Although Sean, your 50% lift in Germany thing has really got me thinking that I need to start doing that for Pilacase and some of like, cause we do really well in Germany and that probably should be like a solid 8-figure business all on its own for us if we put some freaking effort into it.
Yeah, there's very few languages that are actually worth porting over, right? It's English, German, French, maybe Spanish, maybe Italian. It's like you're covering a lot of the fucking world when you start doing that. And then Asia is a whole different thing, right? Like, yeah, you have to probably – Japanese is so different than English. You're going to need a whole different website, a whole different experience.
Yeah, I actually had somebody describe going to Asia as like just – it's like you're going to another planet. Like it's not another market. It's another planet. It's like, don't lump like China or Japan into like your market expansion thinking. Treat it like another planet, like mental models. So I, Mike, I don't know, or Jason, if it was you who mentioned Mexico as a, like, because I'm on the other side of America, I don't know a whole lot about Mexico. I've been there once. Do you just turn on Mexico as like, I ship here? Do you have to like localize in Spain? Like how do you get Mexico as an audience, as a market? Like, is that a good market to expand to? Or would you advise people to go to UK first or EU first before they try to ship into Mexico?
What I've historically seen is that UK and Canada are the lowest hanging fruit. It's a combination of the market size, consumer similarity to the US, and the English piece makes it the easiest. And I would say, and I'd probably put, I might even put Australia next before you get into any market. Australia is a long way away, but I would probably put those as the top three. Even going back to the days of Quibids when I worked with my brother, the markets that we were able to make work the easiest, and really we weren't able to make some of the other markets work, but were Canada and then Australia and UK. But also, I think the question, Matt, like Mexico with Amazon, you can, if you're a marketplace seller, you can turn on, I don't remember what they call it, there's some kind of North American fulfillment network thing that you can turn on where your inventory just becomes available to people in those markets. And it's like, well, you should do that. I mean, that's a no-brainer. But in terms of like how much effort and focus should you put on Mexico, I would say not very much anytime soon.
Super cool. That's great, man. Any thoughts on markets before I go to the next question? Because I'm gonna shift it a little bit in the next question.
Matt, 23% doing nothing. You're not targeting other markets on Facebook, or?
Oh yeah, no, we run our ads there, but like, literally, like duplicate ASC campaign. You know, Europe. Like there's like no other sophistication than like duplicate, change country to Europe.
Yeah, that's what, Jason, that's what you should be doing.
Right? Like that's the level of sophistication.
Yeah. Like you already make the creative, you already make the product. Let Facebook do what it's good at. It'll find
Jason, give me your ad account. I'll do it right now. I'll fire up sales in Italy for you. Like it's so easy.
He'll only charge 5%. Is that easy?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I'll be really generous. No,
I can't wait till my team hears this episode, by the way. Seriously, this is gold.
It is like the markets thing. So, and here's the crazy thing, guys, we actually ship the majority of our European orders from Canada. Like, cause we're print on, like we're manufacturing and print on demand. So like 80% of my total business in Pila Case ships out of freaking British Columbia, Canada, into the US, into Europe. No, it's like a Ridge wallet. I'm like, dude, they're this big. Right, like
how dare you compare that to the value you get in a Ridge wallet? I'm just joking.
You're right. Yeah, my bad. No, the shipping piece, it does help that it's small. But if you have a small product, like you don't even need to think about localizing inventory to just start.
Yeah, and one point that I've been saying a lot in our business is that everything makes sense at a certain level of scale. Right. So if you're Nike, you have a whole swarm of people that all they do is think about marketing in Mexico, you know, or Argentina. Like this is the Argentinian marketing team, but like they're at a certain level of scale. And I think Sean gave some really good advice that if you're like, we have to have people that are just thinking about how to sell Ridge wallets to people in France, and that's all they think about, then it's probably not going to work for you as a company. Like the numbers are probably not big enough and not good enough for it to make sense. But if you're at a place where you can fire a test bullet and hey, showing ads, you know, in English that are not optimized in any way, if that creates acceptable results, then for sure, as we scale that thing and as we lean into it with resources and specialties, then it's going to get even better. So I love that kind of concept, Sean, of like, almost like a proof of concept, you should be, you know, trying this stuff with what you're using in the US that works. And if it's producing acceptable numbers, then maybe you can invest more resources and more people into it.
What's up, everybody? Sean here from the Operators Podcast. You might know me from my famous Twitter profile. You might know me from, I guess, this podcast, but I'm also a huge supporter of SendLane. If you are trying to take a bet on the Klaviyo IPO, might as well take that bet, take that money, switch over to SendLane. It is guaranteed to pay dividends because it will be cheaper. If you want to hear about SendLane in person, I'll be at the event September 18th in San Diego. Huge event, sold out. We're going to do a live podcast. Hope it gets recorded. Bye. I just did a bunch of push-ups, so I'm pretty tired. Talk to you then. Bye.
You know, I love this topic of markets so much because like we've been doing it for a while. Most of my family lives in Italy. I think I've told you guys this, right? And it's like there's 75 million people in Italy or some stupid number. Like the UK is like 70 million people. If you look at the 27 countries that make up the EU, there's 448 million humans in just the 27 EU countries. So when I say like literally just take the damn campaign, dupe it and change it to Europe, just do that. And then that's going to give you data on like, oh, people really like this in Italy or France or Spain or whatever, right? And that's with you just hitting the duplicate campaign button in Facebook.
Yeah, I have some real data that I'll just share that before we localized Germany, Germany was probably bumping around. I mean, I'll call it $1 million a month by itself or something, right? You know, give or take, I'm just speaking out of my ass. But in the same period, France would do $60,000, right? And that's a big red flag. I mean, both English language, no localization. It's like, you know, Germany's only 30% bigger than France. So do French people hate Ridge wallets, right? Like, are there, like, you know, they do
people
have
in France hate everything.
Right. But so I think actually people are pretty simple. There's definitely our core customer in France, and we could totally get them. But the key takeaway from that is English language penetration is just way less common in France, right? So we went to German first because it's a bigger market, immediately saw a 50% increase in results. And it's like, okay, the next we're doing is France. By Q4, we'll have France up. And I'm guessing we actually probably see a 5X increase, right? Because like people are people, that doesn't make any sense, right? A person in France, a person in Germany, a person in fucking Texas, it's like, yeah, you're all basically the same, right? And the second point I'll make about a market like Mexico or a market like India or a market like Turkey is there's rich people everywhere, right? That's what I always say, right? And
you're 100% right about that, Sean. I don't mean to cut you off, but it's so, so important. Like, look at India. Like, it's a very poor country, but there are still, like, it's such a big country that the wealthy number of wealthy people in India is substantial.
Like, dude, markets. China is the best example. Like, you know, the average person in China makes $8,000 a year, right? And they got a 1%. And when you got a billion people, 1% is 10 million, right? LVMH, Coach, their biggest market is China. And it's because they have a fuck ton of people. So there's rich people everywhere. If you're selling a disposable consumer good, not a commodity item, you can find customers anywhere. That's what I'm saying. That's what Jason's agreeing with.
You know, the European, like your comment on Germany versus France, like I will say, like my wife's family's French, and my Italian family does a lot of business in Germany. They do a lot of business in France. And what I will say is, like, from experience, localizing in France means a shitload more to their, like, they are very proud of their language and their culture, and they're way less English forward. You're nailing that, Sean, right? Like Germany, they're so pragmatic culturally. They're like, no, this is a great product. I will just buy it.
Do you know in France there is a language board to bring in English language words into France because they do not want the degradation of French culture?
Yes.
And
it's such an interesting thing when you see it. It's so admirable, right? Like, I find France incredibly frustrating, and my wife loves it. And, you know, like my Italian family, they love it. But it makes sense to me when you say that, like, that checks. But either way, like, look, the lesson is, Jason, stop being a little and just duplicate the ads.
Good. I'm glad. I cannot wait for my whole team to listen to this. And one of them is going to be at my house this weekend. The one who's been fighting me is going to be at my house this weekend. So, but you know, Matt, this whole thing, all these questions that we're taking today, the number one thing that just reminds me of for today's Panzerism is that actually you need to debunk everything you hear. And like, it's funny that people are asking these questions, but nobody should take our word for it. Like, you need to go out there and fucking debunk everything, call bullshit on everything, be a contrarian. I constantly see this. I've been having this conversation internally about creative, and we want to do some new, different creative campaigns. There's a couple of campaigns that have worked really well for us. And one of our team members, who is really a pro, been around a long time. It's like, we need to get some big agencies to come in here and pitch us. And I'm like, I'm hearing big agency, I'm hearing big dollars. I'm like, wait a minute. Why do I need to get these huge agencies that are coming and want to do like multi-million dollar campaigns when we've sold over $500 million worth of Hexclad, like just doing it our way? And it's like the conventional wisdom and how things were done in the past, it doesn't need to apply. And I'm constantly fighting with people, and I'm like the oldest one often in these fights, and just saying like, you need to debunk this right now. Like, stop telling me why this is, I don't see the data. I don't, just because it's been done this way forever doesn't mean it's the right way. And I think that's even more important today. So like, our questions are, it's great that we're fielding all these questions, but also I'm just gonna say like, debunk everything we're saying and debunk everything everyone is saying.
Yeah, none of this is dogma. It's actually one of the questions I was going to ask you guys, Jason, was on this, which is, what beliefs, do you have an example of a belief that you actually had to break to get to where you are now? So like, you thought, like, you believed something to be true, right? And it turns out that for your path or your company, like it actually wasn't true. And Sean, I know we've talked about this, man, like this whole, like, every brand needs to find their own path up the mountain. Like, you can't follow the footholds of like somebody else. I always use mountains. I'm just not a war guy in business. But like, Jason, I think, like, I'd love to, if you guys could, do you guys have examples ready where you could say like, you know what, that was a best practice, or I did believe this to be true, and it turns out for us, it's not. Like, does anybody want to take a shot at that along Jason Spanzerism?
This is really on the spot. I'll just say that everything.
You love these fucking brain teasers, Matt. Jesus Christ. What is you and Sean with the fucking brain teasers?
Because I got Sean. You know, Sean's at least gonna have one.
Well, I'll just say my entire life is strong beliefs held loosely. It's like I believe anything until I'm proven otherwise, and then I move on in my day. There's nothing that jumps out to me that's like, oh, I was totally wrong about that. I mean, because I'm wrong all the fucking time. I'm wrong literally 70% of the time. And I'm like, oh, okay, I changed my mind. A joke is that I say that I'm never wrong because my position is so fluid.
You don't stay wrong. It's like, I have lots of wrong thoughts. Every day I have a wrong thought about our business. I just don't hold on to it once I learn that it's not the right way to think about it. And maybe that's kind of the point that, I didn't mean to cut you off, Sean. I just think you're making a really good point that the skill. Go ahead.
You said it better than I ever could. Now I'm cutting you off to tell you how fucking succinct that was. Say it again, because this is the Beckham of the week.
You don't stay wrong. Like, you're going to have lots of thoughts that don't turn out to be true. Intelligence isn't a lack of being wrong. Intelligence is that you're willing to be fluid and elastic in your beliefs to the data. And that you're like, one of the things that I think is fascinating is that we talk about pivoting. Like, pivoting is something you do in the very early stages of a company and when you're trying to find your way. Man, I feel like I pivot weekly, daily in my thought process in some ways. Like, and maybe this is the piece of advice I'd give, that the thing that makes you a really successful entrepreneur is getting really comfortable with the idea that you're constantly pivoting, that you have this constantly evolving model in your head of how to run the business, how to address the market, what customers want, and you're constantly running these little experiments and trying to learn more. And then you're willing to, at a drop of a hat sometimes, walk away from a point that you fought for 3 months, you know? And that's happened to me, where I've been like, this is gonna be great and we're gonna do this. And then we try something and the data comes back and it is not a good idea. And it's like, okay, that idea sucks. I know it was my idea, but it's terrible. The data has shown that is not the way we want to go. We want to go this other way. I'll even do it in meetings sometimes, where I'll argue a point and then somebody else will say, I don't know about that because of this. And I'm like, oh, well, now that I know that, yeah, that was stupid what I was just saying. Let's go with what you're saying, because that's more informed. And so there's really a form of humility, I think, that gets built into being a good entrepreneur, where you're not afraid of looking stupid. You're not afraid of changing course.
That's true leadership. Mike is just talking true leadership. I mean, I want to hear from you, Matt. I want to hear from you, Jason, but Mike is just nailing it down. And maybe you guys have real examples, because Matt, you asked an actual question with real results, but I love what Mike's saying.
I can give you I'll give you a super tactical one. It's actually you know, Sean, when you were showing us how Ridge does your creative key and how you track your creative production thing and that whole machine that you've built. One of the things that we went out and did with Lomi was we started, we leaned really hard into UGC, right? And just create a variety that was driven by UGC, only to find out that it is terrible for that product. It just didn't work. I threw 400, and I'm not a bad ad guy. I know how to run ads. I've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on ads. And I'm looking at the fact that
I keep seeing the ad with you, Matt. I mean, I love when I get that Lomi ad.
It works for Lomi, right? This thing that worked really well for Ridge, and it actually works really well for Pillowcase, it just doesn't work for that product. You know, and I thought this is so many brands are doing this. This will work. No, not at all. Nothing could be further from the truth.
You know, a big one is that Ridge has an LTV problem, right? I have the worst LTV at anyone on here. People could buy more pants. People could buy more water bottles. People buy phone cases every year. They do not buy more Ridge wallets, right? And yeah, true. Shout out Marty, dude. Favorite bestie. We know that's a problem. And I told the entire team, we're going to solve it. How are we going to solve it? I do not know. I'm like, we're going to tackle it from every fucking angle. I'm releasing every product. And I'm like, if it's Ridge beef jerky, we're going to push it out there, whatever it takes to increase LTV. And that is just having the humility to be like, hey, look, I know there's a problem. I don't know, man. We're going to try everything. And when we find something that works, I'll tell you that oh yeah, that was my vision from the very beginning, right? But it's like, nah, I have no fucking idea. So I think it is finding your own way up the mountain, because we climbed it in different weather conditions.
That's great. Good panzerism, Jason.
Thanks, guys. And on that note, I gotta hop shortly. So
should we do you guys want to call it here? We've probably been going for an hour. I got one more we can do too, or we can just call it here. Because Sean, I know you got a plane to catch.
Yeah, I have to call an Uber in 2 minutes. So maybe we'll do rapid fire. What's the question?
All of us have business partners. What makes our business partnerships work? And is there anything that you find frustrating about having business partners?
30-second answer, everybody.
Sean, go.
Okay. Of course it's frustrating, because you're not a dictator, right? You have to care about someone else's feelings and thoughts and everything, right? I have a lot of business partners, but my main one is Connor. And the reason why it works is I'm an 80% guy. He is a 20% guy. What that means is I'll give him the rough idea. I'm like, this is basically what I'm thinking. Here's some of the work done. And he will sculpt and refine it to make it a beautiful, perfect thing. And
Mike.
Oh yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead, John. I thought you were done. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I was just going to say that without me, he would be working on a smaller project, and he'd work on $1 million, $5 million, or $10 million project. And without him, I'd be homeless. So it's a good balance.
Go ahead, Mike. Then Jason, I want to hear your.
Many of you guys know Brian, who's a co-founder with me, and I would definitely recommend having a co-founder. I think one of my big things with Brian is we just have a fantastic relationship and a real friendship. And I don't know what I'm trying to say here, other than surprisingly with us, building a business together has made us closer. And he's one of the few people in the world that really, I think, can fully relate with my life. And there's something really powerful about that. I mean, I talk to a lot of CEOs, and even if they do have close friends or community, there's so few people that understand, you know, the life that we live and the stressors that come with it and the challenges. And so to have a co-founder who understands all that I've known for a really long time, and our friendship has only deepened, has been a real I mean, it's been awesome for me. It's been one of the best parts of the experience.
Yeah, Mike, I want to tack onto what you just said. Work with people who you like to hang out with. You know, we used to say that back when I was a banker, when we would hire in new people to our firm. It's like, I'm not going to hire you if I don't want to go have a beer with you, go have a drink with you, have a meal with you. It's table stakes to if you're going to partner up with someone. Like you have to just really genuinely like each other, because you're going to fight, you know, you're going to disagree, and you're going to have to deal with that. And it sucks, you know, it sucks when you go at it with your business partner or your colleagues at work. But like, you have to know that it's going to happen. I fucking hate it, but the point is, like, you really like the person. At the end of the day, you can get past it just because you kind of genuinely enjoy their company. And so I think we all have that, and we're very fortunate.
Agreed. I'll give you, I wrote about this sort of like this business partner dynamic probably 2 months ago in my newsletter. There's like five truths that I've sort of like settled on when it comes to having a partner and like really understanding like how's it going to make it work. Right. So I'll give you the five truths. Right. Each of them is true for each partner in the relationship at different times. So that's the important variable in all this. So the first is, one's going to work harder. One will create more value. One will be the face of the company. One will be ready to quit before the others. And one's going to have personal problems that are going to impact the business. All of that will be true at one point or another for each partner in the business. And as long as you're aware of that, you can have a good business partnership.
Those are good words.
There it is.
I do like the idea, Jason, what you said.
Sean just peaced out. Sean just peaced out. He's gone.
I love it. He's like, I'm just done. I did love what you said, Jason. I love the idea of one of the best things about having a business partner is having somebody who challenges you. You know, the conflict is a feature, not a bug. You know, that someone where you can do conflict well with is a really great aspect of a co-founder, because none of us make the best decisions by ourselves. And so having somebody you trust where you can have conflict and you can disagree and you can, you know, fight about an issue, and then, you know, the friendship and the relationship still intact is a really powerful thing.
Yes, sir. All right, boys.
All right, kids.
Let's wrap it. This was a great episode. I like answering the questions, and I'm happy that Jason called out our own bullshit. Please don't listen to any of us. None of us are actually that right. Seriously, if you're listening to this right now, the only person you should ever be wary of is the person who sounds like they have all the answers, including us.